Hey folks, this is David Silconet back with another episode of American History Untucked. It's been a long time since we've had a show. Lots of reasons for that, things going on here and craziness and all kinds of things that have kept me from recording as many episodes in the past few months as I'd like to. But we're back with another show and I'm really excited about this because we're going to hopefully be on track for this year to be... be a semi-regular podcast in as much as these things happen. So, my guest for this episode is somebody I'm really very excited to talk to. It's Ari Kelman. Ari is a professor at Penn State University, and he's probably best known for his book, Misplaced Massacre, which came out a couple years ago on the massacre at Sand Creek, which won, I think, pretty much all the awards it could win. The Avery Craven Award, the Tom Watson Award, the Bancroft. But in our conversation today, Ari and I talk mostly about his most recent book, a illustrated history of the Civil War called Battle Lines, a graphic history of the Civil War, which is really an effort to try to address many of the concerns of the sesquicentennial in the form of a graphic novel, for lack of a better word. As you can tell from our conversation, there were lots of other issues that we sort of touch on that we sort of ran out of time to get to fully. Maybe we'll have Ari on the show again later. But here's a really fun conversation I had with Ari Kelman about a week ago. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So I have a question first about this new book, Battle Lines, which just came out, I guess, beginning of the summer. Is that right?
It came out in the beginning of the summer, and actually there's a story behind that. You're already picking scabs. Because I begged the press to get it out maybe 3 or 4 months earlier, so we didn't miss the final death throes of the sesquicentennial celebration, such as it was. And the press, for its own reasons, which I suspect have a lot to do with internal marketing concerns more than anything else, wasn't able to do it or didn't want to do it. And so it just sat in warehouses. And I have all of these illusions, all these lies that I tell myself about how many more books I'd be selling if only it had come out a few months earlier.
It must be frustrating to know they're all there somewhere and you attempted to break into the warehouse.
Oh, they were sitting in their warehouse. I mean, they sent us copies of it in... I think I got my copies in January, so, you know, a good, well, almost half a year before the ostensible end of the war. I mean, I don't know when we want to say that the war ends, or maybe it's still going. We can talk about all that later. But, you know, we had a bunch of months where there were still a number of articles being written and a lot of coverage in major newspapers. And we knew that the book was just sitting in the warehouse, and we were sort of sitting in our respective, well, I was sitting in my house and Jonathan was sitting in his apartment, you know, drumming our fingers on the table and periodically calling each other and saying, why won't they just release it? But again, you know, they, I don't say this lightly. I mean, I actually think they know better than I do. And this is more just a story that I like to tell myself about, why we haven't sold more books, right? This was a before the fact
stories about why our books don't sell.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I needed to pre-rationalize my failure. And so this was a convenient way of doing that.
So when I went to go and pick up my copy here, I found a bookstore in Edinburgh that was carrying it, which was probably harder to do than it should have been. So I went to the bookstore to called around, found a place that had it. And I went to the desk there and said, okay, where can I find your book? And she said, oh, that's going to be in the graphic novels section. Yeah. I tried to explain it wasn't a novel, but she didn't care. She pointed me in the graphic novels section. Went there, couldn't find it. Found the guy there who was supposed to run that section of the store. He said, no, that's going to be in the history section. Went up to the history section, couldn't find it there either. I had the two guys arguing over which section the book belonged in. All in the meantime, I said, I don't really care. I just want the damn book. And eventually they found it. It was in a box in the back of the store somewhere.
Oh, dude. Come on now. You're hurting me.
I'm, you know, the buyership for Civil War books in Scotland isn't going to be huge anyway. But
they found, like, you know, it's me and maybe people that I assign books to. But for the record, which section do you want the book located in if you had to pick?
Both.
Okay.
And I also want it front racked, and I want it in self-help and a few others. I mean, Jonathan and I went back and forth on this a lot, and he persuaded me in the end that graphic novel is a catch-all term that just means illustrated book, and that Mouse gets called a graphic novel. I'm trying to think of really good examples of books that aren't novels but still get labeled that way. Fun Home is a good example, right? Alison Bechdel's
undergraduates want to read this summer.
That's exactly right. It's so inflammatory that if they were to read it, they would literally burst into flames. So what Jonathan said, and in the end, I ended up thinking that he's probably right, is that calling it a graphic novel is really not the end of the world. It's not going to be some kind of massive crime against the historical profession. It's not going to be, I'm not going to blight the Brown history department and somehow get drummed out of the union or whatever. I'm okay with it. I mean, I think it's imprecise, but I also think that whole genre and I mean, there are ways in which I think this is what makes the genre interesting, but the whole genre is pretty imprecise, right? You know, in the end, the whole genre is pretty weird, right? Graphic novels contain multitudes, and so while I do have some misgivings about the idea that this book is being called a novel, because I don't think it is, mm-hmm. And those misgivings deepen, I think, considerably because I fight with my undergraduates constantly not to call nonfiction books novels.
Yeah. Everything that's not a textbook is a novel.
That's exactly right. Every single friggin' semester, I've got students who are saying, you know, Frederick Douglass in his novel, I want to beat them. I mean, not literally. If my dean is listening to this, I should be very careful. Given Penn State's recent history, I have to be probably super careful. I take my responsibilities in loco parentis very seriously. But at any rate, I mean, having it called a novel is from that perspective frustrating to me. But on the other hand, it is what it is. And so when you say that you can't find it in the bookstore, that worries me much more than whether you could find it in history or in the graphic novel section.
I think it's probably just incompetent booksellers, but which I will not name here to
No, please don't. I don't want to get you in trouble at home.
So was the origin of this book? What's made you decide to, you know, not write another monograph, but to sort of go into this relatively sort of virgin territory for academic historians of working on a graphic novel?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a few different ways to answer that. And I guess the broad answer is I have a deep-seated self-destructive streak. and I have pretty much spent my entire career figuring out ways to screw myself. and I know that sounds really kind of improbable given how much good fortune I have, but, you know, kind of at every turn, well, I mean, I'll give you an example. When I was in graduate school, I really wanted to write about Native Americans during the era of the Civil War, which I've subsequently ended up doing. But in this case, it wasn't my own fault, but my advisor passed away. And so I ended up writing an environmental history of New Orleans for my dissertation, which then became my first book, right? And it was, you know, not particularly successful, though every bit as successful as most of us want our first books to be, which is to say it got me tenure and then it died a polite death, right? and then it got resurrected by this horrible storm, sure. Katrina, whose 10th anniversary we've just celebrated. But idiot that I am, I didn't say to myself, oh, well, you know, I've had more success than I deserve as an environmental historian. I should stick with this. I decided that I was going to double back to doing Native Americans during the era of the Civil War. Okay. And then while I was at Davis working with that, I, like many, many people that I know, I struggled mightily writing the second book. You know, it was not easy for me because I suck. And so while I was mired in self-loathing, which I guess is always for me, but in this case, it was particularly bad, I started blogging, which, you know, again, was a total self-inflicted wound, right? It was something you didn't have to do, but decided to do anyway.
Yeah.
And it turned into a gigantic time sink. Or it turned out to be a gigantic time sink and also earned me a reasonable amount of infamy, right? You know, like the blog that we had lots and lots of readers. And so it was around the time that I stopped blogging that Eric Rauchway, my colleague at Davis, and I, we stepped back from Edge of the American West. It was a going concern, but we were no longer directly involved with it. It was around that time that I got a phone call from an editor at a university press and I'm actually going to keep this person nameless because she doesn't deserve to be implicated in any of this nonsense. And she called me, and I was driving across Wyoming with my family. And it was summertime, and we used to drive, when I lived in California, we used to drive every summer back and forth from California to Ohio, which is where my parents live, where I grew up.
That's a fun drive.
Yeah, with two kids in the back, nothing could be better. you know, it's one of those few moments where I truly was part of the cult of Steve Jobs. Thank you for inventing the iPad. So we're driving across Wyoming, and I get this phone call from this editor who says, you know, this, by the way, is in the run-up. It was like 5.5 years ago. Because again, let's keep reiterating how much I suck and how slow I am. And she said, hey, do you want to write a really short, really accessible Civil War history? And I said, you know, maybe, but you know, I'm kind of right now in the swamps of despair with this Sand Creek book, and you know, if I can pull myself out of that muck, maybe this other thing would be interesting. How many words do you have in mind? And I swear she said something like 35 or 40,000. I mean, it was a
that sounds like two chapters at the most.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It was like, to me, it sounded like a really, really long New Yorker article, yeah. Right? And on the one hand, I totally dig the idea of writing a really long New Yorker article about the Civil War, but on the other hand, it was in that moment, and it remains today, really hard for me to conceptualize how you would write anything meaningful for a university press about the Civil War in under, I don't know, 100,000 words. I mean, it doesn't matter what the exact word, but at any rate, I said no.
That's probably a wise choice.
I think it was. And I also said no because I knew that they were, again, not to get sort of deep into the weeds of the politics of publishing, but I knew that that same press was also negotiating with some other people for similar topics. And I didn't want, as someone who at that time in no way was associated with the field of Civil War studies, I didn't want to be an intellectual carpetbagger, right? Like I didn't want other people feeling like, wow, Ari wrote this incredibly glib, kind of stupid, because inevitably it was going to be kind of stupid book. And also these other much more talented, better known Civil War historians were writing books for the same press at the same time. You know, what was Ari thinking?
Yeah.
And so I passed. And then because I'm totally neurotic, I spent days and days and days kicking myself around the block because, as I just said, in that moment, I wasn't at all well known as a Civil War historian.
Yeah.
In fact,
that was an opportunity you could have.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, I don't think anyone thought of me as a Civil War historian except myself and my colleagues at Davis, at UC mm-hmm. Davis, because I'd been hired there to teach Civil War history. They sort of took a flyer on me, and I gave a job talk about Sand Creek and the Civil War, and they bought it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Or they didn't have better options. I mean, I don't know. Or they did have better options, and they say no when they were offered the job. I really don't know, and I don't want to know. And so I was really bummed, and I became kind of obsessed is too strong a word, but I became, well, maybe obsessed isn't, you know what? What I did is I figured out a new way not to write the Sand Creek book. And that was by obsessing about how many words I actually, what's the fewest possible words that I could tell the story of the Civil War in, right? What's the minimum word count? And I looked at my Civil War lectures and I started, you know, banging this around. And I wasn't actually, just to be very clear, I wasn't thinking about going back to the university press, but I did just, I got fascinated by this question. And I then, I'm not exaggerating, I really was, you know, I was like lying in bed one morning thinking about this. And I thought, oh, you know, I should. What about a graphic history of the Civil War, right? What about a comic book?
Were you a big comic book reader before this?
Totally not. And Jonathan, it's a bummer that he's not part of this conversation because he would at this point step in and just start making fun of me relentlessly about how little I knew and know about the world of comics. I had read a little bit of X-Men when I was a kid. I'd read a little bit of Fantastic Four in both of those cases in my cousin's basement. My cousin was a big collector and he had full runs. And he was very nice and would let me read these books of his. But other than that, I never read comics and I never read graphic novels. So I to this day have never read Mouse. My mom's a Holocaust survivor, and I've never looked at Mouse. I have since the book was published, and again, not before it was published. I've read Fun Home. I've read Rabbi's Cat at the recommendation of a bunch of friends of mine, and a few others. I'm blanking on the totally brilliant author's name. But the Marie Curie book, Radioactive. Sure.
If you didn't know anything about graphic novels, what drew you to that as a format, other than the fact that you could cheat in your word count that way?
That was all it was. It was purely instrumental. It was just mechanistic, and I thought, okay, this is the answer to a puzzle, right? But I also knew. There was an editor at that time who remains incredibly highly regarded named Thomas Labine. And he was at Hill and Wang at that time. And I knew that Thomas was doing these graphic books. I knew that he had done a graphic version of the 9/11 Commission report, and they did the autobiography of Malcolm X as a graphic book. And so after I had this idea, and I had been looking for an excuse to pitch something to Thomas, I had wanted to work with this guy really badly. And so I pitched this to him. And Thomas is, in addition to being an almost absurdly astute editor, he's also a very, very shrewd businessman. And he said, you know, the equivalent, well, we'll keep it in the cartoon realm, right? Like his eyeballs turned to dollar signs, right? You know, it was like, cha-ching, what goes great together? Graphic books and the Civil War. You know, what a wonderful idea, Ari. But he, because he's a smart guy, said, you know, I want you to write me a proposal. And I did. I wrote this proposal, which to some extent lives on in battle lines, because what I came up with was the hook for making the Civil War graphic. And, you know, obviously there are more than two entendres there, but in this case, I literally mean visual, was to have each of these chapters built around an object.
Yeah, sort of like the history of the world through 100 objects or whatever it is the BBC did
exactly
years
right.
ago.
That's exactly right. And Thomas said, okay, this is good. But on the other hand, he looked at this proposal that I wrote and he said, you know, you've written a really, really outstanding proposal for an academic book for a monograph. You know, this is garbage. but he said, you know, but don't bother rewriting it. What I want you to do is meet this illustrator that I think you're going to get a big kick out of. And so I talked to Jonathan, who's my co-author. He ended up not being just the illustrator. I mean, he is the illustrator, but he ultimately ended up co-writing the book with me for a variety of different reasons, most of which having to do with the fact that I had no idea what I was doing. And Jonathan and I did hit it off. Jonathan had studied history as an undergraduate at Stanford, and then he'd gone off to Italy where he'd apprenticed himself to a binder of fine books, you know, which is a real growth industry, like even more so than being a professional historian. and then he'd come back to the United States and in classic sort of, you know, 50s movie star fashion, rather than going to the soda shop in Los Angeles, he went to New York and shopped himself to a bunch of the major publishing houses and said, you know, I want to work in your art department. And as he describes it, at each of these different places, they all said, you know, we actually hire people who have degrees in art. You know, like this is a profession. It's not an avocation. Yeah. And so buzz off, weirdo. But when he got to FSG, to Frost, Strauss, and Giroux, whoever it was in their art department said the same thing. But then said, but hey, you know, we've got this editor here, Thomas Labine, and he collects weirdos. So go and have a meeting with him. And Thomas, at that time, had a book under contract with a historian who, by the way, to this day remains nameless. I don't know who this person was. And the book was a history of the atomic bomb. And he wanted, when he met Jonathan as an undergraduate had done a graphic Beowulf and a few other. Cool. Thomas looked at this at Jonathan's portfolio or his, whatever it is that artists drag around with them, I don't even know, his curated space. and he said, you know, look, this is kind of a weird one, but I want you to work with this historian and do this book. And then eventually the historian, I guess Jonathan and that historian, the historian and Thomas, I think, had kind of a rocky beginning of the project, and then that became rockier once Jonathan was attached to it, and so they eventually paid the historian to go away. And like I say, I still don't know who it is.
I need to figure out how to do that.
Yeah. So you know how you pay historians to go away? We it's pretty cheap, I bet. I mean, you know, I'd go away for not much money. So Jonathan then did this book, Trinity, which is this graphic history of the atomic bomb. And so Thomas asked me to meet with him. I read Trinity. I thought it was really great. Jonathan and I talked on the phone a bunch of times, and he and I then reworked the proposal together, and Thomas then put the book under contract for a pittance. And I mean, really, I hope Thomas hears this at some point, but, you know, totally exploitative, you know, just really, really brutal, like sewing soccer balls with our teeth in militia, wages. And that was it. And then Jonathan had to teach me how to do this.
And so what was the process in which you guys weren't in the same place, right?
No, I was in California, in Davis. He was in Brooklyn, which, by contract, that's where all artists have to live. the process went like this. I would rough out, well, I mean, it actually evolved. The initial process, I roughed out a chapter and sent it to him. And he called me on the phone. I emailed it to him, and he called me on the phone and said, you know, not only isn't this good, it's toxic, right? Like,
how the hell can I draw this?
Yeah, yeah. He said, you know, you can't send me shit like this because it's beyond distracting, right? It makes it impossible for me to come up with anything useful. And he had to actually teach me that when I was scripting something, I needed to follow what I've subsequently learned is a pretty standard industry format, right? It looks much more like a movie script than it does something that you or I would write. So it's you say panel one, and then you explain what the art looks like in panel one, and then any dialogue that might be in that panel, and then panel two, and so on and so forth, and you figure out how many panels you're going to have on a page, or you need on a page, and then you move to the next page. And I never got good enough at that I felt comfortable with it. And so what ended up happening, the process that ultimately evolved is that Jonathan and I would talk on the phone for hours and hours and hours, and I would talk through what I wanted a chapter to look like, and he would jot down notes and then rough it out in this format. And then he would send that to me, and then we'd talk about it, and then he would draw a very, very, very crude first draft of that chapter. And then we'd talk about that, and any changes that we wanted to make to it, and then we would put that in the can, because he didn't want to do final art on anything until he had a completed draft. And it wasn't until the last chapters that we were working on that I actually got to a point where I could say, as I said to you just a moment ago, okay, here's what we're gonna do. Panel one's gonna look like this.
Yes.
And so he did just an immense amount of handholding and an immense amount of writing, and that's how he became, again, not just the illustrator but the co-author on the book.
Now, what were the, I imagine, the set of values you bring to a book like that as an academic, and the set of, you know, concerns he has as an illustrator are going to be fairly different. Were there points where he wanted to go left and you wanted to go right, or where he wanted to do something and you said, no, we can't do it that way, or where he wanted to do something, he said, no, there's no way in hell I can draw that?
Yeah, I mean, there was no overt conflict. I mean, I think there were a couple of moments where I felt sort of tense, or he felt kind of grumpy. And every time they cropped up around similar issues. So the first thing that we had to hash out was, doubling back to the beginning of the conversation, was whether or not it was going to be a novel. And And he wanted it to be a work of fiction. He had written this book, he'd written Trinity about the atomic bomb, and he had felt enormously constrained by the historical record. And he had felt like, well, I mean, right, like we've all been there, right? You know, it's really, really annoying that we are supposed to be true to what actually happened.
It's much easier if you can make stuff up.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, we like to tell ourselves it's much easier if you can make stuff up. Having tried to write a novel on my own, I'm not actually sure it's easier to make stuff up. But at any rate, so what we ended up coming up with was a kind of, well, what we ended up coming up with is what you see in the book, which I think of as something that's experimental as a work of history. It's a sort of hybrid where we do have characters that are fictional, but they are always in non-fictional settings that are informed by historical sources. And we drew a very, very bright line around the issue of putting fictional dialogue in the mouths of nonfiction characters. And so the book has only been reviewed, just as an aside, in a scholarly venue once. And that review is very, very positive, but I'm sort of waiting to see if there will be more, mm-hmm. and if someone's just going to hammer me, because it'll be me. They wouldn't hammer Jonathan because he's allowed to do what he wants, right?
Sure.
But if they're going to hammer me for again some of these decisions, but so we had to work that out, and then once we worked it out, we 99% of the time, 99 point something percent of the time, Jonathan and I were totally on the same page. There were moments, though, where he would say, where I had a particular idea. So I became totally focused at one point, and this was a chapter in the original proposal. I became completely focused on the idea of having, you know, you're a Civil War historian, so you know what I'm talking about. But some of the classic soldiers were, some of the classic statues, memorials where you see a so-called standing soldier and a kneeling slave.
Slave, sure.
Yeah, I became obsessed with.
We actually have one of those in Edinburgh.
Do you really?
Yeah, we have an Abraham Lincoln statue that has a slave sort of kneeling below his feet.
Oh, that's classy, with a K. So,
hey, we actually have clans here. They're just very different clans.
Yeah. So I wanted to tell the story of the Emancipation Proclamation using one of these statues, mm-hmm. and I wanted the two figures in the statue to come to life and effectively start arguing with each other. About what they were depicting, and I wanted to get at the question of whether or not these are classic historiographical arguments. I have no idea whether or not your listeners give a shit about any of this stuff, but I wanted to get at the question of whether or not the slaves freed themselves, whether or not Lincoln freed the slaves, whether or not Union soldiers were agents of emancipation. I mean, again, of these are sort of critical historiographical
big questions of the sesquicentennial. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And I wanted to do it with a statue, with a talking statue, using Jonathan's phrasing. And he just, he was like, "You're an idiot. This is a terrible idea, and it's not going to."
I think it's a good idea. I think this still needs to come to fruition.
Sure, but he was like, it just doesn't translate to the page, and it's cornball, and not, you know, so he simply refused. And then he turned about his fair play, and he then became the last chapter of the book. I wanted some kind of a nod to the work that I'm really interested in, which is the Civil War in the West and Reconstruction in the West and Native peoples and the relationship between emancipation and dispossession, between liberty and empire, you know, on and on and on and on and on. So I had this idea to have the last chapter play out on a train and to have various sort of archetypal characters colliding in this one space moving into the West. And it's what we ended up doing because I'm smart and he's not. But he became equally intent on having the last chapter take place at the 1876 Centennial Exposition, because he wanted to draw a World's Fair. And I was actually, you know, sort of okay with that, but it didn't really work. And so we went back and forth for a million times. And then finally I said, you know, look, draw it. You know, I mean, if it's great, it's going to be great, because he'd been right about enough stuff and I'd been wrong about enough stuff that I'd learned to trust him by that point. And he tried drawing it and called me, you know, 3 weeks later and said, this sucks. Forget. we're going to do the other thing. So I mean, we would have minor disputes like that, but for the most part, what?
Ari, you appear to have cut out again.
Easy, and I mean easy, not in the sense of it was easy to get the book done. It took us forever. As I said, it took, you know, 4+ years to do this, a project that I thought was going to take 18 months. And it was for Jonathan particularly, it was incredibly grueling work, because he had to actually execute this.
Sure.
He had to make it come alive on the page, while I got to sit in California and get emails with PDFs attached. Sure. And say, you know, that doesn't look quite right. Could you, you know, I mean, I got to give him notes, which again, I think occasionally he found himself thinking, you know, this guy's...
What the hell does this guy know about drawing?
Yeah, it's exactly right. He's an asshole, right? Like, this guy is first of all, doesn't respect what I'm doing here. And second of all, it's really easy for him to keep on saying things like, that image looks racist to me, right? You know, like, over and over and over again. Because it turns out...
Is that a big
out,
problem?
Oh, it's a huge problem. It turns out that drawing... African-American, the faces of African-Americans when you are a white illustrator in a context in which Trayvon Martin is being killed and so on is a hyper-political act, right? It's not as simple as just saying, oh, well, you know, there's Frederick Douglass, because there's all of this. I apologize again for sort of getting into the weeds of the work that I do as a scholar, but there's all this cultural imperialism, right?
Sure.
Where you're spending your time depicting someone who hasn't asked you, the white illustrator, to draw that person. And it was really fraught. And I, as a historian who wasn't doing the drawing, but who was going to have my name on the book, found myself thinking over and over and over again, you know, this is really terrifying and potentially consequential in a way that I'm not comfortable with.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
that I don't want readers looking at this book and saying these two white authors are exploiting, particularly exploiting, African-American dead bodies.
Sure.
Right, because there are a lot of dead bodies in the book, because a lot of people died during the Civil War. It kind of sucked, and so we were really that became something that we were really, really anxious about, and all of that was playing out while, you know, from my perspective, kind of the two most interesting things that were happening during the sesquicentennial were, on the one hand, the New York Times disunion blog, and on the other hand, which had very little to do, comparatively speaking, with our project. But on the other hand, this blogger and journalist, a guy named Ta-Nehisi Coates,
oh, yeah.
who you know him and your readers may know him. He's now, I think, a contributing editor at The Atlantic. I don't know what his title is. But he's just published an extraordinary new book, which is a letter to his son. It's modeled to some extent on Baldwin's Fire Next Time. But he, Coates, while we were working on this, was going through this amazing journey of discovery in public on his blog, where he was writing about, you know, he was reading McPherson's Battle Cry of Freedom and kind of live blogging his reaction to that. And then he would discover Eric Foner and live blog his reaction to Foner. And then he'd move on to Gary Gallagher and Drew Faust and, you know, on and on and on and on and on. He never got to my work, the jerk. But so this is going on, and from where I'm sitting in California, you know, what Coates is doing is the most interesting stuff that's happening during the sesquicentennial, and he's writing extensively against the notion that the war was any kind of a tragedy. Mm-hmm. Because for Coates, the war is a war of liberation.
Sure.
And he's right about that, by the way. I completely agree. But, you know, classic historian that I am, always adding nuance. I don't know if you saw, but Kieran Healy, a sociologist and also a blogger, just wrote a scholarly paper called "Fuck Nuance." And
that's an awesome title, even if I don't
it is. It's, you know, well, it's actually a really brilliant. It's a really brilliant, brilliant piece too. So, but I mean, here I am adding nuance. So, but I mean, in my view, Coates was right about that. But the war was also a tragedy, and so we're trying to write a book that at once captures the triumph of emancipation, but also the extraordinary tragedy of a nation that decides that in order to arrive at that moment, it needs to bathe itself in the blood of its citizens and rip itself to pieces, and then also grapple with the limits of emancipation during and after the war. The question of how free the freed people would be. And so, as I say, trying to draw these people was really, really hard.
Yeah.
And it was the thing that we ended up spending the most time with sitting with real misgivings.
Well, one of the things that I'm just in looking at it that I imagine must have been very difficult is, and you mentioned sort of scholarly reviews and dealing with nuances, is who the target audience for this book was. You know, when we're writing a monograph, we know more or less who the eight people are who are going to read it. But with something like this, who did you think was going to pick it up?
So unfortunately, that's another long story. Initially, When Thomas and I talked about this, we really thought, and again, Thomas with his Looney Tunes dollar signs, right, cha-chinging in his eyes, he thought this was going to be a kind of a straight survey of the Civil War that he would be able to sell in huge piles to high school, maybe AP U.S. History, and then college surveys. And he was very, very excited about that because he thought that we could do something that was interesting enough, but not so weird that we were going to end up alienating readers. But because Thomas, despite playing the part of a very, very straight, preppy editor, he's actually quite a weirdo himself. You know, he knew that I'm an oddball, and then he, as I said earlier, he's a collector of weirdos. And then he introduced me to Jonathan, and so it was already becoming weirder just in my hands, right? I mean, I wanted to tell the story of the siege and fall of Vicksburg from the perspective of the gut of somebody who was prostrated by illness, somebody who was starving and then who was going to die of malaria,
which is not usually covered in your AP US history textbook.
That's exactly right. And I mean, you know, and Jonathan then ended up saying, that was one of those things where Jonathan was like, what kind of idiot are you? You can't actually have you can't actually have an entire chapter take place inside somebody's stomach, right? Like that's it's very dark, right? You know, like I'm not but I mean already I made it weird, but then once Jonathan was attached to it, Jonathan's again, this is a guy who apprenticed himself to a binder of fine books, and it, you know, he's a total oddball. And so we made the thing weirder and weirder as time went on. And then in the middle of our writing the book, actually it wasn't in the middle, we had a complete first draft. So it was, as I mentioned earlier, very, very rough pencil drawings that Jonathan did. And we had a complete first draft of the book done. And we sent it off to Thomas, and we didn't hear from him in as timely a fashion as we normally do, at that point. And then we got we both got separate phone calls from him saying that he was leaving FSG and going to Random House. And so we were screwed because the book was orphaned. And he said, you know, I think FSG is still going to publish it. It's really good. It's really interesting, but I have no idea, right? I'm leaving, and the person who is taking over the Hill and Wang graphic book series, and her name is Amanda Moon. That he said, you know, I don't know what Amanda's going to want to do. It's up to her. Actually, in that phone conversation, we didn't even know that Amanda was going to take over the Hill and Wang graphic books. And so, you know, we were, I guess it was 2 years into the project, and we had this draft, and we were hosed. And then a couple months later, we got a phone call from Amanda telling us that she was now attached to it and that they wanted to keep doing the book. And so that was a huge relief. And then a few months after that, Amanda wanted to have a long phone meeting with us, and we had that meeting, and in the course of that meeting, Amanda said to us, you know, this book is super weird, and really, really.
Is that a compliment or what is that?
Well, it was sort of a compliment. I mean, and she said, and really wonderful, and we really love it, and we want to release it for not just a textbook market, but also for a general adult readers. And what that meant in practice was that rather than doing the book in black and white, in a portrait format, she wanted it to be in landscape. She wanted it to be full color. And Jonathan and I, and this is the one where I actually totally blame him. We were like, awesome, full color. And then it was only like a week later.
Again.
That's exactly right. It's like a week later, Jonathan calls me and he's like, you know how we agreed to do this book in landscape and in full color? Yeah. You know, everything we've done up until this point, isn't going to work. And I was like, dude, what the fuck? What is wrong with you? You're supposed to know that. You're the art guy. You're
you should have said that in the meeting. Yeah.
Yeah, you're my mentor. Like I don't know anything about this stuff. And so it ended up taking an additional 2 years because what we discovered was that first of all, we shifted the way it was being written to some extent because we felt like we could add nuance, sorry, Kieran Healy, because we felt like it was going to be marketed to, again, adult readers. But we also discovered that when things are in landscape rather than portrait, they're more expansive, and so we could add panoramas. And it turned out that, as anyone who's done this kind of graphic work knows, that the pictures actually carry the narrative. And so the storytelling changed, and the way that we were conveying ideas changed, and some of the ideas changed, and on and on and on and on and on. So the answer is that we started out writing a book that we thought was going to be one thing, and it turned into a book that was supposed to be something else, and we have no idea whether it's any of those things. Like we don't know whether it's selling to anyone, right? We don't know.
We'll find out 6 months from now.
It's exactly right. We don't know whether it's being adopted for course use. We don't know whether we just have no idea. Mm-hmm. That's the long answer.
So I don't want to make a connection here between this book and your last one. And the only connection I can think of, and I don't know whether you've seen this movie because it's the worst of the trilogy, but in Iron Man 3, they make a reference to the Sand Creek Massacre.
Oh yeah, the Mandarin.
The Mandarin uses
in one of his Bin Laden videos talks about Sand Creek. Yes.
And do you think his description of the Sand Creek Massacre was accurate?
Oh gosh, what
did
he say?
Were you excited? Well, first, did you see the movie, and were you excited? We say, hey, that's my book they're talking about.
One of the very weird things about writing about Sand Creek was that I never developed any sense of ownership of the topic.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think that that's endemic to the topic. I don't think that it's Sand Creek. I think it's the way that I wrote the book. And what I mean by that is that most people who work on Sand Creek get sort of drawn into this vortex, and they then spend decades working on that topic mm-hmm. and reworking it over and over and over again. And that's going to be true of me. I mean, I'm going to have a chapter that's going to feature Sand Creek prominently in the book that I'm writing right now. Well, not right now. Right now I'm talking to you, but I mean... the book that I should be writing right now, we should go, by the way. But by the same token, it never, because of the totally weird way, journalistic, anthropological, call it what you want, that I wrote the Sand Creek book, it was always very, very clear to me that that story isn't mine. That it belongs to the Sand Creek descendants and maybe to some extent to the National Park Service, though I don't actually think it does belong to the National Park Service. I think that the National Park Service is just holding that story in trust for the Sand Creek descendants. And so when Sand Creek pops up in something like Iron Man 3, or I don't know if you saw, but Ned Blackhawk on the 150th anniversary of Sand Creek wrote an incredibly beautiful and very, very moving piece about Sand Creek in the New York Times. And I got tons and tons of email from people saying, dude, aren't you bummed? You know, like Sand Creek's your topic.
Okay.
And I was like, but it's just not, right? I mean, I have no claim over this topic. I was extraordinarily fortunate that these people were willing to let me squat on it temporarily.
Yeah.
And so when it showed up in Iron Man 3, I was like, oh yeah, that's weird. Oh. And I spent a couple minutes trying to engage with it. I'm serious. Like I do remember getting a transcript of what he said, and I remember thinking, oh, that's a weird way to care. But then I was like, you know, I'm not going to do much with this. And the truth is that that the reason I didn't do much with it, and again, this is maybe further afield than you want to be going, and I apologize, but that. Because of the way that the Sand Creek descendants, because of the way that I constructed Misplaced Massacre, and because the Sand Creek descendants agreed to speak with me on the record, not all of them, I should say, the Southern Arapahoes would not, but because three of the four different Sand Creek descendants organizations and the people they represented agreed to speak with me on the record, I had and have a pretty keenly developed sense that I'm not going to write about that topic in any kind of a contemporary context without involving the descendants themselves. Yeah. And And so for me to have tried to engage with that, I mean, the only thing that I've written about Sand Creek since then is a piece that I did for Commonplace, for the online history journal. And that piece was sort of outtakes from the book. And so, you know, with the Mandarin, I was like, oh, yeah, I don't know what to make of that.
Threw me out of my watching experience because I was thinking about your book for the next 5 minutes and I missed whatever explosions or whatever it is that's going on in the movie.
I didn't like Iron Man 3 that much either. Yeah. And so I didn't pay that much. I don't even think my kids liked Iron Man 3 that much, to be honest with you.
It is the weakest of the trilogy.
But, yeah, definitely.
But I know I've eaten up too much of your time already. So I really want to thank you for taking some time to talk with us about Battle Lines and a little bit about Misplaced Massacre. And it was great talking with you.
Yeah, it was really good talking to you, too. Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it. And we can do it another time if you want to.
Okay, folks, well, that's the show. As usual, you can follow us on all the usual places, on Twitter, on Facebook. If you want to have ideas for the show, you want to pitch to me, you can reach me at AmericanHistoryUntucked@gmail.com. But until next time, this is David Silkan. I'll talk to you later.